When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation with Chicago paranormal investigator, Tony Zabelski. Tony is a longtime Chicago paranormal investigator. He's worked with several paranormal groups in the area and loves sharing the haunted history of the city. He also hosted the Chicago Hauntings video series for CBS Chicago. I'm Carol Hughes, in for Tony Bruschi, and on this episode of The Grave Talks, we're going to talk about some of the Windy City's most haunted locations with Chicago Hauntings tour guide, Tony Zabelski. Tony, I would love to start with the Iroquois Theater, because on December 30th, 1903, it had only been open for a few weeks. They had a fire, a huge fire. The theater had been advertised as absolutely fireproof. Obviously, that wasn't the case.
The real claim was that it had this theater-length fireproof curtain, which theoretically, if like a fire broke out in the theater, the curtain would have divided the theater in half if it came down, hung from the ceiling initially. And then because it was fireproof, the belief was that the fire would have just been contained on one side of the curtain. It wouldn't have spread to the other. So that would have made it easier to put it out. So those are the reasons why they were saying this theater was fireproof. And the fireproof curtain, by the way, was made of wood pulp and asbestos. That was the combination they used to make that. So yeah, getting the theater open on time, it really was not ready to be opened on November 23rd. The building was still far off from being completely constructed. But to get the building open on time, the owners of the theater end up paying off city inspectors, telling the inspectors, you let us open right now, you pass us through, even though we don't have the fire alarms set up yet, or the sprinkler system set up yet, or the fire escapes completed, things like that. You let us go through now, and we'll open through the holiday season. When we get into the winter, we'll fix all that. So the inspectors let them do that. They passed it through.
Had they done the right thing?
Right, exactly. But the typical of Chicago, you pay off somebody, give them a little bit of money. I mean, I think it's kind of typical of any big city, really. People kind of say it's Chicago only, but any big city, you pay off the right people, you give them the right amount of money, they're usually going to do what you want to do.
Now, the theater that day, they were doing a show, which I think is kind of interesting because I saw it had been billed as a children's show. It was far from a children's show. It was about a man who murdered his wives. They turned it into a children's show saying that all the wives showed back up at the end. So, look, they weren't really murdered.
Right. Yeah. It was called Mr. Bluebeard was the name of the play. It was about a man who murders his wives, and supposedly when he did that, he'd hang them on meat hooks in his closet.
So bring your kids.
Bring your kids, yeah.
This will be a great
fun
show.
For the entire family.
How many people do they think were in the theater that day? Do they really know?
Well, capacity would have been 1,700.
Okay.
There are theories that they may have let about 2,000 people into the theater that day.
Because it was common
it was
back
a matinee.
Then for them to stand and get a cheaper ticket if you stood.
Right. Yeah, get a cheaper ticket to stand in the walkways or in the back of the theater. Very common back then. You wanted to sell as many tickets as possible and make as much money as possible.
How did the fire begin that day?
Well, they said it was an arc light, like a spotlight above the stage, which shorted out. Which makes me question things right there. If this was a brand new theater, wouldn't they have had a brand new spotlight, which shouldn't have shorted out, but who knows where they got that spotlight from. But when it shorted, it starts on fire and it throws sparks in an area below it where they had some things for the set stored. And there was some costumes there, paint thinners, things like that, some flammable stuff that it would have ignited a curtain. That's how it got started.
Once the fire started, was the audience aware there was a fire, or was that more backstage at that time?
See, that's really hard in researching it to understand. Some stories say that the audience initially was not aware what was going on. But then all of a sudden, the play stopped. And they were wondering why the play has stopped. Stories say that Eddie Foy, who was the lead of the play, one of the comedians, a well-known comedian of his time frame, got up on the stage and told people at this point that the reason they stopped the play is because there was a little fire backstage. He initially told people not to worry and not to panic. This theater is fireproof, reminding them that, and that the fireproof curtain is going to be coming down pretty soon, and they should be able to contain that fire, get it put out, and get on with the show. There are stories that say he actually even started singing a little song to the people so they'd remain calm. He also, I guess, says that if we have to evacuate the theater, we'll do it in a very orderly, calm manner. So initially, most stories say that the people remain very calm in the beginning. But then as that fireproof curtain was coming down, it ends up snagging. And even attempts to people to manually jump up there or climb up there to pull it down, they can't get it down. So that's when people start panicking more. They realize this curtain that's supposed to be fireproof, that's supposed to contain the fire and stop the spread of it, isn't going to work. So then people start looking for the fire exit doors at this point. Initially, they couldn't find any of them. They were not marked or put any lighting above them, because the theater owners didn't want lighting above those. They thought it was distracting to the show. They didn't get around to marking them yet. The cast and crew does get out of the building. They were the first to start exiting because they had fire exit doors right beyond the stage. But of course, when they open those doors, that introduces air to the building. And when air comes into the building, it causes that backdraft effect. And that just throws more fireballs right into the theater, causing more panic. So you can imagine in the dark, fire burning behind you, people panicking, smoke everywhere, trying to locate these exit doors, and then trying to open them because they couldn't open them either. Later, learning that all of the fire exit doors had been locked with huge deadbolt locks.
Oh.
Again, the owners of the theater locked them that way to deter people from sneaking in and getting a free show.
So they had locked all those people in. Mm-hmm.
They had locked all the people into the theater. Some of them were able to get these deadbolt locks open and get out, but people up in the balcony, they tried to exit, leading to the fire escapes. When they opened those doors, got onto the fire escape, eventually about 120 of those people fell to their death in the alley, called the Alley of Death. Alley of Death and Mutilation is what the newspapers were calling it. Those people fell to their death trying to exit the building to the fire escapes because the fire escapes hadn't been completely put in. There were like some platforms leading out, but the rest of the structure leading down hadn't been completed. And people not realizing this, when they open the doors, they see that and they think, oh, they're out, they're safe. And everybody's pushing behind them. They end up pushing each other off onto these platforms. And eventually, because there's no device to go further down, they all end up falling to their death in the alley.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, like a total terrible tragedy.
And they say that 602 people died that day?
That's the estimate, about 602 people. It could be, you know, give or take a few. Then when people couldn't get out the back end of the building, they run to the front, under the marquee where they first came in. But it was difficult for them to get out that way also, because the doors, unlike doors you see in buildings today, which if you're coming outside of a inside a building outside, you would push like the bar on the door, a public door, and it would open outward.
You don't
the Iroquois theater doors pulled inward. They weren't able to pull the doors back with all these people behind them. That's where they say the majority of the deaths occurred, right at those exit doors.
The buildings I was reading around the theater then became morgues and triage hospitals to get all those people out of there.
Initially, the firemen didn't even respond to the fire. There was no fire department there during at least the first half of the fire because they never got an alarm. It was a stagehand who pulled a manual alarm on the street that alerted the fire department that there was a fire there because the alarms in the building hadn't been hooked up yet. But yeah, like you said, several buildings were used as like temporary morgues, triage hospitals. The most prominent of those buildings was the Marshall Field Department Store, which is just around the corner, probably less than a block away from where the theater is. Building is still there, Macy's Department Store now. Are you familiar with Marshall Field's Department Store?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I never knew that it was connected with that theater in any way, especially in such a tragic way.
Yeah, Marshall Field, the man himself, was not using the eighth floor of his building for anything at that point. So he, when hearing of the tragedy, allowed them to turn that eighth floor into the temporary morgue and like triage hospital for the victims.
So when you think about how tragic and all of the panic and all of the emotion and an overwhelming sadness that goes along with such a tragedy like that, the fact that I've heard stories of hauntings does not surprise me.
Oh, yeah, me either. Oh, definitely.
Because they rebuilt a theater on that same place, on the same ground, correct?
Yeah, right. And that's always been a theater since 1903.
And I've heard of actors seeing, and I'm sure patrons seeing, apparitions in the theater.
Yeah, there was actually an actress named Anna Gasteyer who was in a play called Wicked several years back. She was a Chicago actress from the Second City Comedy Club who eventually was on Saturday Night Live for a bit, who did a celebrity ghost stories show about the apparitions and things that they experienced, her and other cast members, when they were there in the play Wicked, the original cast of it, several years back. One of the encounters I know they saw was like a mother and her children wearing very old-time clothing, like backstage. And they thought that was very odd that, you know, nobody in the play was dressed that way. And how would have audience members gotten back there? And why would they have even been dressed that way? And then they said they looked for these people again and they could not find them.
And I suppose you living in Chicago and doing the ghost tours, have you, I'm going to guess you've heard a lot of stories about the site itself as well as the alley. Have there been sightings in the alley?
Oh, yeah, lots of sightings in the alley. People tend to see shadow figures there. We get some of our best pictures on the ghost tours from that alley. But there's especially along the back wall. Some theories say that back brickwork is there's some bricks still there that are original to the old Iroquois Theater. Not 100% sure about that, but some believe that because they do end up rebuilding the theater. In technicality, they were right. It was fireproof on the outside of the building, but not on the inside where all the damage happened and all the people died. So it's very possible some of the bricks back there could be original. If you look back on the wall, you could see where they kind of bricked up old windows and doors, things like that. But some of our strangest pictures, different colored orbs, tend to happen along that back wall.
What about that Marshall Field building? I had a friend building.
Yeah, it definitely. They say the eighth floor is haunted. That used to be the new employee lockers there on the eighth floor several years back, but they stopped using them as the new employee lockers because the new employees were, the lockers were closing on their own, or they were seeing shadow figures over there. So new employees didn't want to stay working in the building. So they eventually moved the lockers to another part of the building. And I've heard that there's been a few suicides that have taken place on the eighth floor. And that for many years, the eighth floor was empty. I'm hearing now that some business moved into the eighth floor just recently, like within a few months.
When you do the ghost tours, have you had any experiences yourself?
Some of the smaller tours, I used to do a walking tour. The bus tours, I don't normally do it, but on the walking tour, I would bring out a little ghost hunting equipment back there. And now there's a lot of things that could spike a meter back there, so I'm not necessarily saying that those are anything, but sometimes we'd run the ghost box. I'm familiar with the ghost box, a little radio that scans the radio frequencies. And the theory is like the spirits could talk through them. We would get what responses from people who say, you know, fire, and that they died there or were trapped in the building, things along those lines. I had a lady who came on one of my tours who worked part-time as one of the ushers there. She was going to take me on a tour, backstage tour of the building and everything. I met her like very early in 2020, before everything shut down, but then everything shut down, and now she's no longer working there. Yeah, she said that they had experiences. Another one of the claims that people say is that they, in one of the women's bathrooms, they hear like the toilet will flush on its own, and they hear what sounds like a little girl giggling and like running off after flushing the toilet.
You just think about all those people who died and they just went, yeah. They were going to the theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's supposed to be a fun, you know, day at the theater.
I want to talk to you about another location in Chicago, the Congress Plaza Hotel. I actually stayed there once when I was in Chicago because I don't know if something was going on in the city, but I could not find a decent price room. Everything was really expensive. I came across a Congress Plaza Hotel. I'm like, oh, looks fine. Rate's good. So I booked it. We get there and I remember walking into the room and I'm like, oh, it's a haunted hotel. I just knew it. You could just feel it. And so when you mentioned we could talk about the Congress Hotel, I was like, absolutely. It's a very interesting hotel and it opened in 1893. So it's a very old hotel, 871 rooms and suites. So it's a very big hotel. And from what I've read and what I felt when I was there, it's a very haunted hotel.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It was built for the World's Fair coming to Chicago in 1893, initially called the Auditorium Annex Hotel. There's a building called the Auditorium, which is right next door to it across the street. Which was the original hotel. They built not the entire 871 room building right away. They built a half of that hotel, the North Tower, first for the World's Fair of 1893. When I'm asked about the most haunted locations in Chicago, that is always my number one, is the Congress Hotel.
Really?
If any place here is haunted, it's that building.
It's so crazy because when we got there and we were busy and we went and checked in and I didn't think that much about it, but I remember going to the room thinking this hotel is so haunted and I had no experience with it whatsoever. You just feel it. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things you've heard about the hotel and maybe talk about some of who you've heard haunts the hotel?
Well, we believe it's very haunted because there's been many, many suicides in the hotel. And we believe a lot of these suicides are still hanging around there. A Spanish-American War veteran named Captain Louis Ostheim in the year 1900 was staying in the hotel, seemingly in very good spirits. This was on the eve of his wedding, when in his room alone that night, he just took a gun to his head, and they say they see him still to this day as like a shadow figure. They call him the Shadow Man of the Congress. He's been known to like lurk in people's closets and then come out of the closet, or they'll like things shuffling in their closets, which is so interesting because I told that story on a tour in October of last year. I had two ladies sitting on the bus just next to me who were staying in the hotel and had no idea I was even going to talk about that. When they jumped up out of their seats and they're like, we had to call security yesterday because we thought something was in our closet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they say the hotel has its ties to Al Capone. We do know that some members of Capone lived in that hotel. So more than likely, he would have been in there. Some say he had some of his parties in one of the ballrooms, the Florentine room. Some security will tell you there's a room he used to play cards in up on the fourth floor. Like I said, we do know Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik, who was Capone's bookkeeper, lived in that hotel. And Capone and Jake Guzik were very close. The only thing they could connect to Al Capone for the St. Valentine's Day Massacre were two phone calls that would have come from the lobby of that hotel and gone down to Al's estate in Miami, where he was on Valentine's morning in 1929. And they believe Jake Guzik is the one who made those phone calls to Al Capone.
And we are going to talk about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, too, because that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. What about room 441? What have you heard about that room? Because I was reading the most haunted room in the hotel.
That's what they say. They say that that room gets more calls to the front desk than any other room in the building. Mostly people waking up in the middle of the night and seeing a woman hovering over their bed, shaking the bed or pulling the covers. I've investigated the room a few times. We never really had too much activity in there, but those are the stories that are, we actually had more activity in the hallway outside that room. One guy got a EVP one time, you know, the electronic voice phenomena on his recorder. He had asked the spirits if it's okay that we're here, and we were in the hallway outside that room, and the recording that he got said, run. Very clear recording.
So did you run? I think I would have ran.
Yeah, we got out of there.
Don't have to tell me twice.
Yeah, right. You don't have to tell us twice. We possibly think that that woman could be connected to a murder-suicide that happened in the other tower in 1939. A Czech woman, a Czech immigrant family came to Chicago. Well, the mother and her two sons did. The father staying back in Czechoslovakia. They just have the 6-month temporary visa. They do stay several different places throughout the area, eventually ending up on the 12th. Some newspaper accounts have called it the 13th floor because it actually was the 13th floor in 1939, but they've changed the numbering of it, so there's no 13th floor now. They were staying in, again, security tells me room 1234, when the mother slowly started suffering a nervous breakdown because she loses contact with her husband. And one day she takes the kids to the Lincoln Park Zoo. She's very fearful that they're going to be sent back to Czechoslovakia, doesn't want that, that they're not going to be allowed to stay in this country. So I guess she felt there was no other way. But when she gets back to their hotel room after going to the Lincoln Park Zoo one afternoon in August, she opens up the windows, pushes the boys out. They fall 12 floors down to their death, and then she jumped out right after them. And that little boy spirit's been seen haunting that 12th floor of the North Tower. The oldest of the two boys, the 6-year-old Carl Langer. And it's possible that the woman is the mother, but we don't know. That's in room 441. But a very tragic story.
With the history of the hotel being built for the World Fair, I think it's interesting that there's possibly a tie to H.H. Holmes. And if you've read The Devil in the White City, I think it's a fabulous book if you haven't read it, but it's about the World's Fair and a serial murderer at the same time telling the story, but it's a true story. And so they said that he possibly looked for victims in the hotel.
It's possible. We don't have any direct or hard evidence that he picked up anybody there. But it being a brand new hotel at the time, and he opened what he billed as the World's Fair Hotel in his building down in the Inglewood neighborhood on the south side. There's stories that he may have tried to get some people to, instead of staying at like the Congress that were in town for the World's Fair, talked them into staying in his building instead. We do a whole tour called Devil in the White City, where we start at the Congress Hotel. That tour starts there, as do our regular bus tours now. And we go into the, you know, the history and possible Holmes connections to it. And we eventually do make our way to the Inglewood Post Office, where his building would have been over on the south side.
And they say the basement of that is apparently haunted.
Apparently employees do not like going down into the basement.
Don't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if anybody ever gets a chance to go into the Congress Plaza Hotel, go in. I mean, stay mm-hmm. there. Because I didn't have anything happen to me when I was there. I could just sense it. But they've got a ballroom there. That's one of the most fabulous things I've ever seen.
Yeah, the gold room is amazing.
The gold room, that's what it was. It was just absolutely amazing.
And they do see apparitions in there, especially people in 19th century clothing.
So this wraps up part one of our conversation with Tony Zabelski. Don't miss our next episode, where we talk about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre site and the Lincoln Park Old City Cemetery. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts and you can try it for 3 days free, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks and find everything there all ad free. For all of us here at The Grave Talks, I'm Carol Hughes, and thank you for listening.